As you can see, we're going to talk about 153 fish, 153 great fishes, which appears in John 21, 1 through 14. It's that entirely is not about fish, not exactly, but it leads very nicely into 153 of them, so. So 153 fishes, that is a lot of fish, certainly. And it's actually a lot of great fishes. And it's so many fish, in fact, that the text tells us that it was surprising that the disciples' net was actually not broken as they were dragging them out of the water and onto land. So what is the significance? Even a casual Bible student could quickly agree that nothing in Scripture is superfluous, it's not unnecessary, it's all there for a reason. Now, I grew up listening to my father give a lot of speeches, and he always relied on lots and lots of statistics. I have inherited part of that, but not entirely, so I'm going to throw a couple of interesting statistics at you. One is that there are 3,116,480 letters in the King James Bible, that version, which is a lot of letters. And those are strung together into 783,137 words, which is a lot. We read some of those twice a year. And to be completely forthcoming, I did not sit down and count those myself, although we do exhort each other to not rely on the word of one brother in his research. Go back and check it yourself. Make sure we agree with concepts that somebody's talking about before we really make that part of our own Bible notes. In this case, I personally would make an exception for that statistic. I have to admit that I got that from Google, so take from it what you will. And at this point, I'll accept those with just a question mark next to them. There's a lot to study, and the counting the letters and the words in the Bible is, it could be on my list, but not near the top. So to anyone unfamiliar with the Bible, it would be easy with that many letters and words to accept that there could be what I would call interesting yet unimportant topics covered in Scripture. But those of us who read daily and study regularly, this idea of an interesting yet unimportant material is just as easily rejected. We have all come across a portion of Scripture that's so infused with meaning that it could be called remarkable that so few words could contain so much information for us. Now, anyone attending our Saturday morning James classes over the past few months, I think could probably attest to that. Some weeks we only covered a verse, and one week, not too long ago, we only got through half a verse. But I'm not trying to make you think that we sat around just drinking coffee and eating muffins most of the time. No, this was actually, although there was some of that, and munchkins, too. Some of the topics, it was all interesting and very fruitful discussion. Some of the topics were first principles, certainly, but a lot of that conversation was really trying to dig into the text and create some context for what that meant. Some of us probably walked in more than once thinking, gosh, this is awfully early for Saturday morning, because we met at 9 a.m. But I did, hopefully others walked out each Saturday, thinking we were glad to have shown up because we learned a few more things about the Bible that we hadn't known before or hadn't considered. So with that said, what could be the significance of 153 fishes in the reference that's on the screen? Why does the number of fishes that were in the net matter? It would seem that our knowing that the net was so heavy with fish that they could not manage to hoist it into the boat is enough to illustrate the situation in which the disciples found themselves in this particular day. But once we dig a little deeper, we uncover the nuance that lies in all of Scripture. It's like we're sitting in a boat on the water, on the surface of the water, and we sit there and we see the water moving around and the wind comes and it pushes it this way or that. Maybe a fish comes up, breaks the surface, and we see that. Interesting stuff, but if we really want to see what's going on, see where the action is, you have to get below the surface. And that's what we're going to do with this verse, this passage, I mean. So imagine yourself sitting on the surface of the water, and we look at this passage. Jesus shows himself to the disciples, and we find out that this is actually the third time. We know that there's, just in their flyover, we know that there's seven of them. Simon Peter, Thomas, Nathaniel, James, and John, the sons of Zebedee, and two more disciples who are not named. They all go fishing with Peter. It's night, and they catch nothing. Jesus arrives, but they don't recognize him at first. They cast the net again, and this time they catch so many fishes, or so many fish, they can't pull the net into the boat. John then recognizes Jesus. Peter jumps into the water. The rest of the disciples bring the fish to shore. They find there's already a fire there with fish cooking. Simon Peter pulls the net filled with 153 fishes onto the shore. Jesus invites them to eat. They all recognize Jesus. Jesus gives them bread and fish. So that's it in a nutshell. Oops. That's the story. Not particularly interesting, but there certainly is information there. We did get a few facts, but otherwise that approach is pretty plain. And if you think back, that might be our first or second pass through the Bible as a new Bible student. And that's the time when we're just getting our bearings. We're trying to figure out just really what the story is that we're reading. After all, the King James is challenging for those unfamiliar with 1611 sentence structure and vocabulary. No one today says, "We also go with thee," do they? So if Roger says, "I'm going down to get a cup of coffee," I'm not going to say, "I also go with thee." He might look at me like I bumped my head or something. But as we read more and more into Scripture, we become familiar with that aspect of it, and we're able to explore it a little more deeply and glean more information from the text. So we begin this passage today on the Sea of Tiberias. Now, the Sea of Tiberias actually goes by several names in Scripture. The Lake of Gennesaret, which is in Luke 5, the Sea of Chinnereth, Joshua 12, but we are most familiar with it by the name the Sea of Galilee. Tiberias was actually a city. Lies on the southwest portion of the sea, and where there's a lot of mountains, but then there's a plain in there at the foot of some of the hills. And on the southern part of this plain, Herod Antipas built a city around 26 AD, calling it Tiberias in honor of the emperor who had befriended Herod. In verse 2, this is where we see that there are actually seven disciples. Simon Peter, Thomas, called Didymus, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, and the sons of Zebedee, and then the two other disciples. Verse 3 tells us that Simon Peter declares to the others that he's going fishing, and the others join him. We're told that they've spent the night fishing, but they've caught nothing. We can compare this to another instance of fishing that we see in Luke chapter 5. There, Christ instructs them to lower their nets, and Simon objects, saying in verse 5, "Master, we have toiled all the night and have taken nothing. Nevertheless, at thy word, I will let down the net." So we can see that in spite of their experience, they followed Christ's instructions, and they caught, in this instance, a great multitude of fishes. In this instance, their net breaks. The group of them then work together to haul the load of fish into their two ships to the point that the two boats are almost sinking. The men were astonished at this multitude of fish, and they fall down at Christ's knees. And in verse 10 of Luke 5, Jesus says unto Simon, "Fear not, from henceforth thou shalt catch men." Then we see in verse 11 of Luke 5 that the group of them bring their ships into shore and from that moment on begin following Christ. Now, these men were partners in a fishing operation, and they gave all that up to follow Christ at that moment. And that certainly should be a lesson for us, brothers and sisters, that Christ, as we know, and we hear over and over, he could come upon us at any moment in time. And we are expected to leave all that we have, and at that moment, to follow him. We should be mentally preparing for that right now, each day, thinking about that. What will we do at that point in time? With our knowledge of the truth and the expectation of what's to come, we should be modifying our thoughts and our expectations for our own life, recognizing the influences of the world on our current life and turning our backs on those things. Practicing for that day when we are face to face with the messenger who has come to retrieve us for judgment. And we better be ready to go right then. There's no time to delay at that moment. There won't be an opportunity to say, "Just wait one here, 1 minute, and let me take care of this one last thing." It's not important. There can be no hesitation, like these men that we're reading about. They brought the boats into shore, and Christ and the lot of them went off together. That was it. It was time. So here we are back in John chapter 21, looking at verse 3, where we see that after Christ's death, these disciples have returned to their fishing business. I think that's a valuable lesson for these men in this interaction with Christ, is a reminder that their job as fishers of men from Luke 5, and we see that more clearly when we get to the We'll see that more clearly when we get to the 153 fishes. But for now, we see that as they went out in the dark, which is a key item here, they were lacking the guidance of Christ. Therefore, they caught nothing. So if any of us is doing something in the wrong frame of mind or without the correct intention, we are just like these men. We're stumbling around in the dark. We have no hope of success because we lack the illumination that Christ in the scriptures provides for us. Verse 4 is when Christ appears, and it's the point when the morning comes. The sun is just beginning to illuminate the sky. It's that time when the sun, it's not quite up yet, but everything is visible again, and that diffused lighting that really only comes in the morning. It's almost a relief from the dreary, limited nighttime when you can't see very much at all in front of you. Our vision is almost completely useless to us. So there's hope in this verse, contained in this verse. Christ has arrived on the scene, and they can see clearly again. There's clarity, and there's hope. It feels like the time we are living in right now. We can all see that what is going on in the world, how all the indications we read about in Scripture of Christ's return, they're appearing one after another. And it feels like the dawn, and it feels like Christ could appear at any moment, just like his appearance in this passage. He could appear at any moment. In the passage, we see that the disciples don't recognize him immediately, but then he spoke to them. Verse 5, he asked them, "Children, have you any meat?" Now, Christ calling them children seems a little odd to me. These were full-grown men, yet Christ refers to them as children. I think that's how Christ looked at them, but not in a patronizing way, not as little children, but more as a sign of affection that he had for them. We saw in Luke 5 where he's actually, at that point, he's gathered them up, and he's led them around teaching and all manner of necessary and important things that they needed. He's seeing them, in some cases, manifesting his behaviors and doing the things that he's taught them. We see sometimes that he's frustrated with them, but we do see them doing the right thing. That's much like our own children. Our children are young, they grow up, and at some point they begin making their own way. But I still see and think of my daughter and my three sons as my little children, although they're not little. As a father and a parent, I feel protective toward them because Debbie and I have raised them and taught them many things, not all of them, but many things that they know now. And that's what I got from this scene here. Christ has brought them along. He's taught them many things that they will need after he's gone. In fact, in Hebrews 2, it's clear that Christ thought of his brethren as the children that God gave him. If you want to flip over to that, we can take a look at it. Hebrews 2, looking at verse 10 through 13. It says, "For it became him for whom are all things, and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons unto glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings. For both he that sanctifieth and they who are sanctified are all of one, for which cause he is not ashamed to call them brethren, saying, I will declare thy name unto my brethren. In the midst of the ecclesia will I sing praise unto thee." And in verse 13 says, "And again, I will put my trust in him, and again, behold, I and the children which God hath given me." So it's clear that he thought of them not only as his brethren, but as the children that God gave him. So in no sense of the context, contentious or patronizing at all. It's definitely a sign of affection that he had for them. Moving on to verse 6, Christ instructs them to cast the net on the right side of the ship, and ye shall find, he says. So they did, and what happens? They caught a multitude of fish by following his instruction. So under Christ's guidance, they were successful in something that they had failed at throughout the night. The nighttime, a time when Christ was not present in their efforts. Perhaps they had lapsed back to the self-reliance, and it showed they were unsuccessful. But with Christ involved in their work and in our work, and of course Yahweh, we also could be successful in our efforts. It's in verse 7 of John 21 that the disciples realize who they are dealing with. John brings this to their attention, and upon realizing this, Peter jumps in the water after wrapping his coat around him. The text uses the word naked, but I'm not entirely convinced that he was lacking clothes so much as lacking the proper clothes. Strong's definition says without clothing, but it also says ill-clad, and Another definition in there is undergarments only. And I'm more inclined to think that they were fishing in a minimum of clothing because the work that they were doing was hot and difficult work, rather than just out there floating around naked. But either way, Peter recognized he was not appropriately dressed to meet Christ, and he resolved that problem. He held Christ, he held Christ in high esteem and wanted to make sure his outward appearance matched his inner feelings of the importance of Christ in his life. So he made sure he didn't come before Christ in clothing that was not appropriate for that occasion. We see in verse 8 that while Peter was jumping into the water and covering himself with a coat, the other disciples were dragging the load of fish onto the shore, or toward the shore. Peter was correct in covering himself, but he should have stayed to help his brethren. But he didn't, did he? Peter was impulsive, as we've heard a few times in our Sunday school class and examinations of him. He was impulsive and he swam to shore, leaving the others to finish the work. Although Peter acted out of love and respect for Christ, he could have handled the situation differently and not left his brethren to fend for themselves. Now, when they arrive at the shore in verse 9, they see a fire has already been lit, with a fish already cooking and some bread. And in verse 10, Jesus says unto them, "Bring of the fish which ye now have caught." If we read that in Young's, the literal, it says, "Bring ye from the fishes that ye caught now." So it really places an emphasis that in what they just caught when Jesus directed them, they caught the fish. Another reminder that the disciples and all of us need Christ's influence in our lives if we hope to be fruitful in our work. And I don't mean in our work just around the house and at our jobs. It means any work that we're doing for God. In verse 11, we see that in another impulsive act, Peter runs over to the net and he pulls it onto shore all by himself. Again, he didn't wait for the others. He left them behind to bring the fish in, and now he jumps ahead of them to bring the net out of the water. He's not acting with humility. He was so excited to get to the Lord, he swam ahead of the others, abandoning the job. Now, he's rushed ahead of them without the others in an effort, perhaps, to impress Christ. But God does not put us in ecclesias to show how capable and self-reliant each of us is. If that were the case, there really wouldn't be a need for an ecclesia at all. We could just be a bunch of individuals roaming around doing God's work all on our own. But that's really not the case. God puts us in ecclesias so that we can work together, so that we help each other. If we move forward a little bit in John 21, looking at verse 18, Christ says to Peter, "But when thou shalt be old, thou shalt stretch forth thy hands, and another shall gird thee and carry thee." As a reminder to every one of us that we need each other at some point or another. Maybe not all the time for everything, but we do, in fact, need each other. We should all know that. So in this portion of the reading, Christ would have preferred that Peter waited and the disciples with him as a group would have dragged the net on shore. Verse 11 is also where the contrast between Luke 5 and John 21 really stands out. In John, the net is full of great fishes, we're told. In Luke, it's the great multitude of fishes. Great has two different meanings here. In Luke, it's great in number, but in John, it's actually great in stature. In Luke, we see that Christ is among them working. In Luke, he's actually a distance apart from them. In Luke, he tells them to let down the net, just let it down. But in John, he specifies, he's very specific, on the right side. In Luke, we see the net breaking, while in John, the net holds. In Luke, the ships are sinking. In John, there's not. That's not an issue. In Luke, Peter says, "Depart from me." In John, he rushes to the Lord. So I think that what we're seeing here can be two visions of our lives. One where we are dealing with multitudes, and the one to come, when the multitudes are gone, and only those fish that are great in stature remain. It seems to be a vision of the kingdom age. So, what does the 153 fish symbolize? Well, I did some research, and it's difficult for me to say for certain. I did come across a few ideas, but nothing to me that entirely made sense, nothing that was definitive. The most compelling, the most interesting idea to me was that the 153 is the number of people that were blessed by Jesus. Can everybody read that? No. You don't need to. I'll go through a little bit of it. And if you're interested in going through these on your own, I'd be happy to provide you with a slide or a document that has them all. If you take the leper, now I'm just starting up at the top here. If you take the leper in Matthew 8 and 2, so that's one, and add the centurion and his servant, that's two more people. So it tells you over there, that's now three. And Peter's mother-in-law in Matthew 8 and 14, and the palsied man and his four bearers in Mark 2, and you go on down through this list, adding them all up, it's 153 people. I'm not going to list every single one of them. Like I said, I'd be happy to provide it to anybody. We don't have enough time today. But it seemed like a very compelling explanation for what the 153 fishes in the net represent. Those men that Jesus blessed in Jesus' own work. People that Jesus brought to God. It symbolized that those people influenced by Jesus were out to sea with the multitude of fishes. Excuse me. Until that day came for the harvest. And those great fishes will be caught into the net and delivered into the kingdom, because those people are the right kind of people for the kingdom. Those are the types of people that Jesus is looking for. It's an indication and an exhortation to us that we should continue to fish for men and not get discouraged ourselves, because if we work together with the proper spirit, our efforts will be fruitful, just like the 153 in that net. But we don't see it until that day comes. So we can't get discouraged now. The important thing is endure to the end, working in good faith together. In verse 12, Christ invites them to come and dine. And if you look up what that word dine means, it actually means to eat breakfast. Interesting. They've already had the Last Supper with Christ. And now here they stand on the shore at the beginning of a new day, being invited to share breakfast. With Christ, the only suitable fish for the kingdom, preparing to begin a new phase of their lives in service to the Lord. And God willing, brothers and sisters and young people, we will all find ourselves in that same exact situation very soon.